your name. You go by Bro.
I do.
Can you tell me the story?
Sure. It's a name that came from my father. I was born right after he returned from World War II. And at Williams College, where he was an undergraduate, though he didn't complete his undergraduate education there, he joined the Army, as many people did, to engage in military service during World War II. Had a very good friend at Williams named Bro, who was subsequently killed in the Pacific. And when my father came back from the war, he started to call me Bro at a very young age in memory of his dear friend. And it stuck. So when I was tempted to change the name as I got older and it became odd in some ways, my mother reminded me that it was my father's name for me. He died when I was 17. So I've kept it, and here we are. I enlisted in June of 1966 and served 3 years in the Army, including a year in Vietnam in 1968-69. It was a big part of my life. A big part of my interest in the humanities came from that. After I got back from the Army and re-enrolled at Colorado College, I had the great good fortune to come into the company of a number of philosophers, and they helped me understand through their work a lot about what I had been through. And there was one philosopher in particular named Glenn Gray who wrote a beautiful book on his own experiences in World War II called The Warriors, Reflections on Men in Battle. And it was really that book, I think, that gave me insight into how philosophy could speak to my personal concerns, but also how it speaks to the more general issues that human beings confront in their lives. And so I was off and running in philosophy.
And what do you think studying the humanities tells us, teaches us about interactions with everyone that we meet on a daily basis, or about how we should go about our lives?
Well, I think at one level, and it's only one level of what the humanities do, but they are certainly engaged with and helpful in understanding our everyday lives as individuals and with other people in all of the complex and demanding forms of interaction and engagement with other people. They are about human being in context and life with other people at any point of our lives. But they're also about broader things, including history, most fundamentally. And that history is history of communities, history of nations, history of the world, in some sense. I think the humanities reveal how we're part of stories bigger than ourselves, and that one level or one sphere of that story is certainly the human story. And in some ways, we're connected to the whole long history of human beings, as far as we understand. And that history becomes bigger and bigger all the time. But we are part of that story. We're also part of the smaller stories that compose our community histories, that compose our state histories, that compose our institutional histories. And I think knowing where you are in the world and who you are has a lot to do with understanding where you are in those stories. Mm-hmm. So the telling of those stories, the understanding of those stories is invaluable, I think, to locating us both as individuals and as members of these broader communities of which we're always a part.
To back up a little bit, how do you define the humanities personally?
Well, we're always inclined, maybe in the first instance, to talk about the humanities as they exist in academic settings, and that is usually by way of reference to the disciplines that compose the humanities at places like the University of Illinois. But to me, there's the better way, and I think the more revealing way, is to talk about what the humanities, in one way or another, are always concerned about. And that has to do principally with our history, with our culture, with our ideas and our values. Those are domains in which we all live all of the time. And those are the domains in which the humanities, I think, are principally involved as formalized and more systematic ways of thinking about our experience. But it all comes back to our experience in those dimensions of life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the humanities are always engaging with in one form or another, our history, our culture, our ideas, and our values.
On the academic way of looking at them, though, you have people talking about how what you really need to study is that science and that math that's going to cure this disease or build this amazing thing. And there's a lot of talk of STEM, a little bit of talk of STEAM.
Well, there's a lot of understandable fascination with STEM and with STEM disciplines. We live in a world that's hugely informed by and really structured by the sciences and the creations of the sciences and engineering and math. And all of us need to be understanding at some fundamental level of what STEM is about and what it provides. But we're in a point in our cultural history, I think, where we have tended to overvalue STEM at the expense of the arts and humanities, particularly in our educational settings. I think we tend to overestimate the vocational and practical outcomes and significance of STEM, and we tend to underestimate the practical vocational value of the humanities. And so I think we're struggling in this country to hang on to a view of education that speaks to the whole person.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what we ultimately should be talking about, is how do you educate whole people for whole lives in all of the dimensions of their lives that they will have to engage in, whether mm-hmm. they want to or not. Because without that completeness and that wholeness, we're not preparing young people for the lives they're actually going to lead.
And I think within the humanities disciplines of students who choose to study that as their major, you hear a lot of parents going, okay, great, honey, but are you going to be able to get a stable job? If you have parents come up to you and ask, is my daughter or my son going to be okay? What do you tell them?
Well, as a college president, a liberal arts college president, I had a lot of opportunities to talk to parents about this. And the humanities and the arts are enormously consequential in terms of the way they prepare students to take their places in all kinds of organizational and professional settings, where it really matters to be able to think critically and analytically and powerfully about complicated problems, to be able to communicate your thinking in writing and in speaking in powerful ways. You can also look at cases like Steve Jobs, a great example of a way in which the imagination that he had developed in some of his early life mattered more than almost anything else. The other thing I would say to parents, that wherever they end up professionally, these students will end up in communities where they will be citizens of consequence. And to be citizens of consequence, you have to understand something about your history. You have to understand something about the principles of liberal democracy. And you have to be literate culturally in the current circumstances of the United States. And they have to do with values. Life has tragedy in it. It has deep spiritual content. And you know, the more we're in touch with that content, I think the fuller and richer lives we lead.
Mm-hmm. And that, I think, speaks to a program you launched as chairman, the Common Good Initiative.
Its purpose is to draw humanities organizations and scholars into discussion, work upon thinking about these grand challenges that are all around us. They have to do with things like our relationships with the natural world. They have to do with things like the big new questions that are being put in front of us by the advances in science and technology. They have to do with citizenship and how we become productive citizens in this current contemporary context of American life. They have to do with questions like the balance between liberty and security, which we've been struggling with as a country over the last couple of years. There are lots of these big, complicated public issues where, again, we're engaged with culture and history and ideas. And that's where humanists and the humanities really shine. So it's to encourage that kind of engagement with the country's life. Meanwhile, of course, NEH does lots of other stuff, including supporting fundamental humanities research, which we've done a huge amount of here at the University of Illinois. And we're very proud of that work because fundamental research in the humanities is what enables these more applied kinds of questions to come into view and also gives us the resources to deal with them. So as we encourage these public expressions of humanities thinking, we're also No, we have to continue to support the fundamental humanities infrastructure in the country, research, and also the preservation of cultural material that is required for that scholarship and also is valuable in itself as a part of our public heritage, cultural and historical heritage. So we're engaged in some of this deep background work as well, and that will always be the case.
Mm-hmm. I think as a society, we've moved away much more than perhaps we have in the past to talking about the common good. Why do you think as a country we have put less stock on that idea of the common good, or do you see that?
Well, yeah, I think that term in itself is fugitive in our current circumstances. And there are a lot of reasons for that. There are a lot of challenges to citizenship currently. This is a big, complicated country. The political spaces in which we all operate are becoming larger and larger and more complex. And so citizenship itself is kind of a fraught issue currently. And we know that participation in classic political exercises and contexts is diminished. In voting, for example, we continue to see declines in the level of participation and the quality of participation. And as we've seen that concept of citizenship or that practice of citizenship erode, we've also seen this very fundamental idea of the common good also erode. And it becomes harder and harder for us to get out of our sectional or personal interests in order to address these larger questions of what is in the good of the country. And there's very little in the environment that inclines us or prompts us to do that. So both citizenship and this underlying notion of the common good, how do we talk together as a community about the common good, both of those things are, I think, threatened in the current setting. And bringing back those ideas, what does it mean to be a citizen? What does it mean to pursue as a citizen the common good as opposed to my good or our narrow group self-interest? Those are really important questions, and we need to bring that out as a theme, and it's certainly a theme that humanities scholars and organizations have a lot to say about.
Have you found, in the time you've been looking at this, ways for us as everyday single citizens to bring that conversation back to the forefront?
Yeah, I think there are, you know, you find instances where communities are finding ways of doing that in lots of different settings, and all of them have to do with sort of local circumstances and local opportunities. There's a very interesting conversation going on right now that's been prompted by the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia about the meaning of what's called the Second Founding, the celebration currently of the anniversaries of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And there are conversations occurring, some of which we're supporting around the country, about the relevance of those historical moments or that extended historical moment after the Civil War to the current situation in which we find ourselves in this country now with respect to race. It's been a pretty tough year in the United States along questions and lines of race. And there are communities now who are picking up this theme of race relations in the context of this historical celebration of these moments following the Civil War, or meditation on those moments following the Civil War. And that's a really good example of how history and current conversation challenges come together in a very interesting way. So we're funding some projects, actually, that relate those two things together and that engage communities in conversations about race by way of the celebration of the Second Founding. That's a good example of both an issue that we need as a country to talk about and a setting or an opportunity in which we can actually talk about it.
You've also kicked off recently a year-long celebration of 50th anniversary of the NEH. How do you hope that people will be involved in that celebration or be involved in the NEH?
We certainly want people to understand the long history of NEH and its significance in our public life. And so that's one goal of it. We were talking this morning with some folks about the moment in which NEH appeared was this dramatic moment in American history, 1965, the very middle of the Civil Rights Movement, in the middle of one of the most creative periods of legislation, probably in the history of Congress, when so many important things happened: the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the Social Security Amendments of 1966, creation of Medicare and Medicaid, the Historic Preservation Act, the Immigration Act, which fundamentally changed the way we think about immigration. It was an enormously creative time. And right in the middle of it was the legislation that created the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities. And I think that placement is symbolically important because it underscores the symbolic significance of the first major federal expression of commitment to culture in this country. And that was a symbolically hugely important moment. It represents, I think, the importance of a public national commitment to the preservation of our historical and cultural legacy and to our commitment to the cultural dimension of our lives as a country. And so we want people to participate in that, I think, understanding of the importance of this commitment, and to recognize the wonderful work that both agencies have done over time to preserve our cultural and historic legacy, and also to advance the cultural sector of the country.
We've touched on a number of times your view of the humanities being important in government. Almost every time there's a discussion of a budget at the state level, at the federal level, you've got parties that are saying we've got much more important things to put our money towards.
Well, when people say that, I say, well, there's not much more important than the preservation of a vibrant, energetic, democratic political culture in the United States. And I find very few people, by the way, who will argue with that. Also, there's not much more important, it's related to democracy, but it goes beyond it, to the preservation of the cultural legacies of the country and to our history. The other thing I say, and is true, is that this investment is minuscule compared to the scope of the federal budget. The combined budgets of NEA and NEH is about $300 million, a tiny amount in the many billions of dollars federal budget, and enormously efficient in terms of the impact that those dollars produce. I'll give you a good example in NEH's portfolio. Ken Burns, we were his first funder with his very interesting film on the Brooklyn Bridge many years ago. The Roosevelts, which NEA helped fund, was seen by 33 million people in the first week of its public airing on PBS. This partnership we've had with PBS, I was reminded of this because it was just at a PBS board meeting, is huge. We produced over 750 documentary media productions over the history of NEH, most of them distributed by PBS, and hundreds of millions of people have seen these works. So the impact for a very modest investment is enormous. And that's another thing I'm at pains to remind people of when they think about the budget and our place in the budget.
The concern, too, that some people have of, oh, it's all well and good, but let the private sector do it.
Yeah, and that is something I hear, and I have had that conversation with people. Yes, we like what you do, but the federal government should be doing it. Private sector should be doing it. My answer is NEH has invested $5.3 billion in the cultural economy and sector over the last 50 years. NEA has invested about the same amount. So you got almost $11 billion. And to presume that the private sector would have done that is a fantasy. It just would not happen. So going forward, I don't see why there's any reason to believe that whatever future investments we're going to make would be covered or compensated for by private entities. The cultural infrastructure of this country has grown enormously over these 50 years, and NEA and NEH have been a big part of it.
What do you hope to achieve at the NEH over the next 5 years, 10 years?
There are two things that are of utmost importance to me. One is the demonstration of the public relevance of the humanities to the well-being of the country. Number two is to raise and hopefully stimulate thinking around the country, this question of the future of liberal learning and the future of our fundamental educational commitments. We're in a situation where there's tremendous pressure on education institutions. There's a narrowing, I think, of the azimuth of the way we think about education and the way we're trying to arrange educational experience. And I think we've got to open that thinking back up. So whatever I can do personally, whatever the agency can do personally, to stimulate conversation about our ultimate purposes for and in education, both at the primary and secondary level and in higher education, because I think it's all related. And to raise these questions about citizenship, to raise these questions about cultural competence, to raise these questions about the whole lives of young people and the people we're educating, and how in this society, in this time and place, we educate people for the futures they're going to have. Those are the two most fundamental priorities on my mind. If I can make a dent in either of those, I'll be enormously pleased.
I think there's one other, I guess, question, concern that sometimes the academic humanities get, that they are sort of a safe haven for the super extremist leftist political views. Do you get that concern or question a lot, and how do you respond?
I don't get it much at NEH because, you know, we're not in control of the college and university universe. I got it a lot as a college president. I said a couple of things. One was that, at least at the institutions I was involved with in a leadership way, it was not the case that there was a stultifying, closed environment politically, and that it was a kind of a misunderstanding or at least a utterly narrow and uninformed description of what was actually going on the campus in terms of the breadth of discussion about things. It is clear to me, and it's clear to many others, that there have been instances, particularly in the last couple of years, of a kind of a political narrowness that has appeared at some institutions in some situations. And where that has happened, I think it's deeply regrettable, and it's not consistent with the utterly fundamental value at colleges and universities that discussion be completely open and unconstrained, except by conventions of normal decency. And so where it's happened and as it's happened, I'm glad to see that leaders have stepped up and condemned it. But certainly in the institutions I've been involved with, there was, I'm absolutely convinced, a very deep commitment, thorough commitment to open debate and discussion about things that mattered. And that's one of the principal values of academic life. It has to be one of the principal values of academic life. And it's something that academics themselves value because they don't want to and shouldn't be fettered in sort of what they pursue and what they say. And it's been one of the values that's been central to American higher education. So that's what I say.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.